Dear listeners, Sai Ram from Prashant Nilayam and welcome once again to Vahini Satsang. Our series on every Thursday wherein we dwell deep into the writings of Bhagwan, into the message that Swami himself penned many years ago, right from the late 50s until the early 80s. And we are now contemplating on Sandeha Nivarani, the book that Bhagwan wrote as a series of articles wherein he posed questions, donning the role of a devotee, and then answered those questions now as the Sadguru, as the Divine Master. Every chapter of this beautiful series of articles, which Professor Kasturi later compiled into the volume Sandeha Nivarini, is filled with pointers, is filled with fundamental truths, is filled with revelations, is filled with directions about our approach to life when we are on the spiritual path. And today we will continue our contemplation on chapter 9 of Sandeha Nivarini. Like we do in every chapter, we have split this chapter into various segments, and we are now in segment 9.2. We did spend the last few weeks on segment 9.1, the first part of chapter 9, and then in the last 2 weeks we have been spending time thinking a little more about what Bhagwan has written in segment 9.2. And today we will continue from where we left off in the previous session. We will listen to what Bhagwan has given us in segment 9.2, and then we will read his discourses, read his analogies and anecdotes that he has given to understand what Bhagwan has written for us in this chapter. So here is segment 9.2.
So Swami, we should not sit with folded hands placing all burdens on destiny, isn't it?
What is important is you should act according to your capacity and leave the result of the action to destiny. It is wrong to desist from the appropriate karma, placing reliance on destiny. If you do so, even destiny will slip out of your hands. Whoever he be, he must engage himself in karma.
Yes, yes, Swami. In the Gita also, Krishna tells Arjuna, even I do karma. The universe cannot go on if I desist from karma. And so, if you withdraw from it, how can you realize the results of your karma? Karma is Purusha Lakshana, the hallmark of men.
You are silly. Is there a different hallmark for women? Karma is Prakriti Lakshana. All beings, men or women, trees or animals, worms, insects and so on, have to do karma. Everything in the universe is bound by this law. Everything that we experience, be it favorable or unfavorable, is its result. Therefore, karma is the characteristic of Prakriti. Do not refer to it as Purusha Lakshana. Paramatma is the one and only Purusha. Prakriti is all Shakti, feminine. You are all not Purushas, remember.
But Swami, there is distinction between men and women in nature, and also in their actions and experiences. One cannot help but accept this difference. In this scenario, how can we say that all are feminine?
My boy, you may imagine it to be so, guided by your natural reason. But the reality is not that. All this is just secular experience. It is superficial and far from the fundamental truth. This is simply play acting, mere impersonation. In some plays, men take the role of women. Sometimes women enact the role of men in plays. Are they therefore men? All these are roles assumed for the drama of life. However, since Prakriti is completely suffused with femininity, all the actors, no matter what role they play, are feminine, not masculine. The genuine Purusha is only one, that is Shiva, the Atma. The Atma is immanent in everyone, but for this reason alone, all cannot be deemed masculine. The Prakriti theatre is like a girl's school where all the roles of the play are taken up by girls. Shakti, which is feminine, puts on all these parts, but do not take the drama as real, my dear fellow.
Swami, even after hearing all this, the nature of the world remains an enigma to me. When one side is seen, it strikes me as real. When the other side is presented, it strikes me as unreal. Nothing is definite.
That is exactly the nature of mithya. It means that the world is mithya. It is neither satya nor asatya. It is neither real nor unreal. You are born in mithya. You are enmeshed in it, and so you cannot distinguish this from that, the satya from the asatya.
Then, setting aside this discussion of mithya, tell me, Swami, about that satya, that Purusha, whoever he is.
The Purusha has neither birth nor death. He undergoes no change. He is Chit Swarupa and Jnana Swarupa. He is wisdom. Dharma or codes of social conduct are not of his nature. So he is not Dharma Swarupa. The Jnana, which is his nature, does not change, is not corrected or supplemented from time to time. It is eternal wisdom. Light is its nature, and so it does not admit a dot of darkness. The sun does not have effulgence added to it from the world it illumines. It will emit splendor whether there are worlds or not. Similarly, the innate nature never changes. The Purusha is self-luminous. He is always the object of knowledge. He cognizes all vrittis or mutations of the chitta or consciousness. The chitta is parinami. It changes and evolves. But the Purusha is modificationless, aparinami, unevolved. The Purusha is wisdom itself, which never changes. No vyapara or activity can affect him. Even when unmanifested, effulgence is his nature. The seed in the soil is the unmanifested form of the tree. The tree is the manifested form of the seed. This change from the seed to tree and tree to seed shows that activity of the Shakti in the seed. This is Parinama. But the Purusha is unchanging, unaffected. He is the seer. He is completely apart from Prakriti. No deed can diminish his glory nor exhaust his personality.
So that is segment 9.2, and in the previous episodes we discussed about how Bhagavan emphasizes that everyone has to engage himself or herself in karma. How, even though there is no obligation on the divine to perform any action, he does not need to do, but the divine still acts and shows humanity the way. And after that, we went on to how Bhagavan mentions that there is only one Purusha. It's only one person who can be called as masculine in this whole cosmos, in this creation. Everybody is feminine. And In the previous session, we spent time on discussing this aspect of how the nature is completely the play of Shakti, the feminine aspect, and only the Atma is the Purusha. And after that, the Bhakta tells Bhagwan, even after hearing all this, Swami, the nature of the world is still a mystery to me, because you say that everything is a drama. Everyone is just putting on different roles. The people whom you think are men, they are also actually women. Everybody is like in a girl's school. Everybody puts on different attires, but basically, ultimately, everybody is just feminine. Just because someone acts the role of a king, that person does not change his nature. It's just the clothes. And that is for a very temporary period. Intrinsically, that person knows that I am a girl. I am not a boy. I am not a man. And when Bhagwan says this, the devotee says, but Swami, all this is so difficult to grasp, because what we see in the world is something else. On one hand, everything seems real in this world. On the other hand, everything sometimes seems unreal. So I'm not able to decide what is the nature of the world. You say that everybody is play acting, this is not real. But when I look at it, everything seems so real. But at the same time, yes, there is also something in me which says that everything is unreal. So what is this mystery? And that is when Bhagwan says that is what is the nature of mithya. And Swami says, the world is mithya. It is neither satya nor asatya. It is neither real nor unreal. Satya is reality. Asatya is that which is not real. And Bhagwan says, it is neither real nor unreal. You cannot tell that the world is the reality, because it is not. At the same time, you cannot say that the world is unreal, because everything seems so real. Every act, every karma, every thought, execution, the repercussions, everything happens in the world. How can you say it is unreal? We face what we have done. So, I'm not able to understand this. And Bhagwan says that, yes, this world, that's why is not real, and it is not unreal also. It's not unreal also, because you experience everything in such a palpable manner. But what the world is mithya. The world is very difficult to translate the world mithya into English. Satya we say truth, and asatya we say untruth, real and unreal. Mithya is something which is probably relatively true. And Bhagwan says that you are born in mithya, you are enmeshed in it. Because you are born in this mithya, you cannot distinguish satya from asatya. In fact, in a very beautiful discourse that Bhagwan gave when he visited Venkatagiri in April 1957, Bhagwan says, how to lead a divine life? No special membership entitles you to it. And Bhagwan continues to explain and says, every struggle to realize the unity behind all the multiplicity is a step on the path of life divine. You have to churn the milk if you wish to separate and identify the butter that is immanent in it. Similarly, you have to carry out certain processes of thought and action in order to get to the hard core of faith that the world is a funny mixture of real and unreal, and that the world is mithya. So Bhagwan says that there are certain processes of thought and action that you have to engage in. Then only you will realize this funny mixture of truth and untruth that this world is made up of. Just like you have to churn the milk, only then you can get butter, though butter is always in it. Bhagwan gives the example of the screen. This is from Bhagwan's Divine Discourse to the staff and volunteers of Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital in Prashant Nilayam on October 10th, 1961. Swami says, the screen is the truth. And just like we see in a movie theater, the images that form on the screen, Swami says, they are false, they are mithya. When you see the film, you don't see the screen, isn't it? When we are in a theater, when we see the images on the screen, our eyes and our mind is so focused on the projections on the screen, on the images, the movie on the screen, that we forget about the screen. We don't see the screen as screen at all. We forget the existence of the screen. We only think about the visuals. We forget that there is a base. But actually the screen is there all the time. It is the screen which is the basis which makes us experience the film. In fact, I remember during my student days, we used to request Bhagwan to come to the higher secondary school, and we would create exhibits based on Bhagwan's discourses. So we would take Sathya Sai Speaks and the teacher would give us a paragraph each, and each student is supposed to come up with a model after assimilating what Bhagwan has written in that paragraph from Sathya Sai Speaks. And I remember the paragraph that had come to me was Brahmam Satya Jagat Mithya. The world is real and the divine is real. Brahman Satya and the world is Mithya. And Swami had given this example of moving images on the permanent screen. I remember a classmate of mine and myself, both of us, we sat together to create a little moving base, and on that we cut thermocol pieces and we created images of men and women, and behind was the screen, and we put a battery so that this thing moves. So this is many years ago. Rudimentary way of projecting the shadows of the moving objects on the screen. And when Bhagwan came to engage him in this, we had put a switch which Bhagwan can switch it on, and the images would move and the reflection would be there on the screen. And then that is how we would explain that the screen is permanent, everything is moving, Brahman Satya Jagat Mithya. At that point in time, as a 16-year-old, we didn't really understand so much what we were doing, but we just tried to do to make Bhagwan happy, just to get that photograph with Bhagwan, just to follow the orders of the teacher. The greatest gift, of course, was Bhagwan would come and you have pictures with Swami, you have that one moment of interaction with Swami, but that is how Bhagwan is. in school days itself, he had exposed his students to these kind of concepts. This is what happens in the Balvikas. This is what happens in Sai institutions. It takes a lifetime to understand these concepts, to really live by them, to really internalize them, to make them a part of your life and living. And that is the reason why exposure to these values at a very early age are so important. They will keep coming back to us at different points of time in our life and revealing new meanings to us. So this is what Bhagwan had mentioned in this discourse to the hospital staff in 1961, when Bhagwan said, Narayana is the screen, God is the screen and the objective world, the Prakriti is the film. So when the play is on, the screen is the base and the objective world becomes filled with these images. The screen is the truth. The worldly life is samsara. It keeps changing. And Swami says it is called samsara because it is samsara. Sara means essence. Swami used to play with the Sanskrit word and say it has very little essence. That's why it is called samsara. Bhagwan would give this example to emphasize on what is permanent and what is fleeting. It is so important for us to focus all the time on what is the basis. At the same time, it becomes so difficult to accept and live with the idea that everything around us is unreal. Everything around us is not true, because we experience this day in and day out. We live, work, eat, sleep, everything in this world. And everything around us contributes to what we are. How to feel that everything is unreal? In another discourse that Bhagwan gave during Dasara celebrations, 1965, 26th of September, Bhagwan gave the example of King Janaka. This is a story Bhagwan has mentioned in several discourses. So one evening, King Janaka was in the Darbar Hall, and he was surrounded by his courtiers, and there were a few people who were entertaining the king. There were musicians, they were singing sweet melodies, and the emperor enjoyed the music so well. And in fact, the performance was so good that listening to that melodious music, the emperor slipped into sleep. He was feeling so tranquil that he actually merged into that tranquility and he slept off. He was sitting on the throne and he had no idea that he had gone from the waking state to the dream state. And no one had the temerity to awaken the king. So they all just quietly slipped out of the hall into their inner apartments. And they went away very quietly. They didn't want to disturb. The king was resting. So only the queen and her attendant were left there. They were waiting for king to come back into consciousness. At about midnight, the king, King Janaka, screamed pitiably and he awoke. The sound, and everyone around got startled, because the king started saying, is that real or is this real? Is that real or is this real? Midnight, King Janaka wakes up and he says, is this real or is that real? So his queen runs towards him and says, what happened? What happened? What are you saying? And the king is telling, no, you tell me, is this real or is that real? And the queen was absolutely puzzled, because she didn't know, what is he referring to? What is this and what is that? And whoever came to the emperor asked the same question. Tell me, is this real or is that real? And he didn't say anything more. No, I have to know which is the reality. So many people came to the king. They wanted to help the king. They felt the king has gone mad because he's only asking this question, is this real or is that real? And he's not saying anything else. People started mourning because they felt something has seriously gone wrong with the king. He woke up from the sleep and he's talking like a madman. There was a sage in the kingdom who heard of this. And he came to the palace and he said, I want to help the king. And he was brought to the imperial presence. And the sage assured Janaka that yes, he will answer his question. He will tell whether this is real or that is real. Provided Janaka gives him all the details of what he saw in the dream. What happened when he was sitting on the throne. And then Janaka revealed. He had no idea when he had gone into sleep. And then he started dreaming. In the dream, he saw rival kings joined forces and they invaded his kingdom and they captured his capital. And the king had nowhere to go, so he ran away into the forest to protect himself. Fleeing from his enemies, he entered into the jungle. He had no food. He was living on bare earth. He was hungry. He was exhausted. So exhausted he was that he was pining to drink a glass of water, to eat something. And he came to the outskirts of a tribal village and he saw a man washing his plate after taking his food. And this king shouts at that man and says, can you give me a few particles of food? I am really, really hungry. And the man gives the king a small morsel of food. And as the king takes that food onto his palm to satiate his desperate hunger, from nowhere a crow flies in. And at that point in time, the crow just picks up that food from his hand, snatches it away. And the king screams in agony and anger. He was the king of such a huge kingdom and now here he's not getting a morsel of food to eat. And in that deep pain, the king wakes up and he asks, is that real or is this real? Is it real that I am the king with all these paraphernalia around me? Is this real or is that real that I was struggling to keep my flesh and bone together for a little piece of bread? That hunger was as real as me now sitting on the throne. That loss of empire was as real as now ruling over the empire. The king says, tell me which is real. Is this real or is that real? That also seemed so real. And the sage tells the king, O king, that is unreal. But this too is unreal. Yes, what you saw in the dream is unreal, but this experience of the physical life, this is also unreal. That was swapna, that was dream state. This is jagrata, this is waking state. That is night dream, this is daydream, as Bhagavan would say. Both are dreams, both are illusions. Both are mithya. They are not truly unreal because they are relatively real. This world is relatively real. It is not absolutely real. It's a temporary reality, a reality that is negated by subsequent investigation and experience. It is a reality that one comes into realization after inquiry and experience. So that was unreal, and this also is unreal, O King. So to your question, is that real or is this real? The sage says, O King, it was you who dreamt. It was you who woke up. It was you who screamed. It was you who asked. Therefore, it was you who existed in both the states. In the dream state, you existed. In this waking state, you exist. So what is true is only you. You alone are real. That I that persists in all these three stages, waking, dream, and deep sleep stage, that I, that is the only reality. That I is the only reality. And it is the I that appears as all this manifested universe. In the Satya, there is no Mithya. In the absolute truth, there is no Mithya. There is no relative reality there. In the Mithya Jagat, in the illusory world, you have to search for that fundamental truth. It is there. You have to search. Someone said, just like you have to churn the milk. In the Mithya, in the illusory world, there is the truth. But one can experience that only when one's mind is rid of all modifications and modulations. Bhagavan says, let your mind be transformed from its present complex confusion into something like the sky which does not bear any mark. Though millions of birds fly through it and thousands of planes move across it, but it does not touch the sky. It leaves no mark on the sky. The sky is always unaffected, untouched, unattached. Bhagavan says, that is the spiritual discipline which will reveal the reality. The reality is all the time there, just like the screen is there. But for us to understand and grasp the screen and not get swayed away by the images, the movie going on the screen, there is spiritual discipline that is necessary. And this spiritual discipline will take us towards physical and mental equanimity. In fact, talking about King Janaka, I'm reminded of another Upanishadic sage, King Yajnavalka. He was also from the time of King Janaka. Sage Yajnavalka authored Krishna Yajurveda. His teachers were Uddalaka and Vaishampayana. In later life, Sage Yajnavalka decides to take up the fourth stage of ashram life, namely sannyas. In the tradition of Sanatana Dharma, you have your life divided into brahmacharya, the early life where you spend time learning, educating yourself and lead a celibate life, brahmacharya. Then move on to grihastha, you become a householder. Then vanaprastha, then you move on to the stage of renouncing the life of a householder and moving on to the forest to contemplate on the true destination of your life, and finally sannyasa, when you give up everything. So sage Yajnavalkya decides to take up the fourth stage of ashram life, sannyasa. He wants to lead a life of absolute renunciation. So he tells his two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani, about his plans for austerities in the Himalayas, and he asks them to divide all his property among themselves and live happily in the ashram. He said, I am going, you please take care of my property and you be happy in the ashram. And Katyayani, She was of common intelligence, so she was agreeable. She acceded to whatever Yajnavalkya, her husband, said. But the other wife, Maitreyi, who had great discrimination, she questioned her husband on the value of the worldly properties. You are giving us all these worldly properties and going away to the Himalayas. What is the value of all this? Can these properties give us true happiness? Then Yajnavalkya says, well, these can grant you worldly comforts, but not the knowledge of the self. Then Maitreyi, who is a sincere spiritual seeker, she questions her husband, you please tell me, what is the source of true happiness? If the true happiness can come from the knowledge of the self, tell me how the knowledge of the self can be acquired. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is a fascinating dialogue between Maitreyi and sage Yajnavalkya. And the sage explains to Maitreyi the nature of the self and worldly relations. And the sage says, O Maitreyi, you were dear to me earlier also. But by seeking to know the knowledge of the self, you have become dearer to me. Now listen to what I have to say. One loves the husband, not for the sake of the husband, but for the self present in the husband. One loves the wife, not for the sake of the wife, but for the self present in the wife. One loves the friend, not for the sake of the friend, but for the self present in the friend. One loves the gods, not for the sake of the gods, but for the self present in the gods. One loves a thing, not for the sake of the thing, but for the self present in the thing. This self alone exists everywhere. It cannot be known. Why? Because it itself is the knower. That was the profound teaching of sage Yajnavalkya to Maitreyi. In fact, because of this, Maitreyi quickly became an enlightened scholar in the Vedic times, and along with Gargi, she became a scholar in the court of King Janaka of Mithila. There is another story from the Upanishads. Bhagavan talks about two birds sitting on the branches of a tree. One bird at the top of the tree is large and bright, of brilliant plumage, and she sits quietly, very peacefully, in deep bliss. There's another bird, quite plain in her colors. She's sitting lower down, busily eating the berries of the tree. Some berries are sweet, some are bitter. Every time she finds a bitter berry, she's repelled, she looks upward. And then she sees this bird which is sitting there silent. And she would be very fascinated how this bird on the top is so silent, so calm. But then again she would get lost in her berries. She would find some more berries. So every time there was this alternating experiences of sweet and bitter berries, that would create disinterest in her. And every time she would look up and see the other bird, which is very quiet, very tranquil. And because of this ups and downs, sweet and bitter experiences, this bird is drawn to the bird on the top. And so she goes upwards towards that bird which was silent all the time, goes near the bird And as she approaches near and near and near that silent bird, this plain bird, he's surprised that what she thought was another bird all the time was only another image of herself. It was her own reflection. As she became quiet and quiet and quiet, she realized that bird is in fact her inner self. When that realization happens, then there is total emergence. We experience the dualities of life, good and bad, the berries of happiness and misery. And there comes a time when you develop dispassion towards these alternating experiences. And then you want to rise above. And as you rise and rise and rise, that's when the awakening happens. And that is when you merge with the self within, which is all the time quiet, tranquil. That is the vision of the non-dual. The normal human tendency is to readily accept pleasure but reject pain and suffering. But greater the suffering, greater the effort and the intensity in trying to overthrow and overcome suffering. When we learn to accept pain, just as we accept pleasure, we evolve to a higher level of awareness and equanimity, and it happens through surrender. Suffering brings us to our proper senses. Suffering instills into us the right spirit and attitude. It takes us to higher life of the spirit. Maybe it is for this reason that Mother Kunti, the mother of Pandavas, always prayed to the Lord that, please ensure that there is suffering in my life so that I don't forget you. For us to rise, suffering plays a very, very crucial role. Thomas Kempis, the 15th century Roman Catholic monk, in the book The Imitation of Christ, says, "It is good for us to have trials and troubles at times, for they often remind us that we are on probation and ought not to hope in any worldly thing. It is good for us sometimes to suffer contradiction, to be misjudged by men, even though we do well and we mean well, because these things help us to be humble and shield us from vain glory. When to all outward appearances men give us no credit, when they do not think well of us, then we are more inclined to seek God, who sees our hearts. Therefore, a man ought to root himself so firmly in God that he will not need the consolations of men. Suffering is good because it will keep you focused on God, so that you will not get carried away by the praise, the credit and miscredit that the world gives you. In fact, suffering is talked about as an adjustment sadhana. Swami used to always say, test is my taste. Through many births, we have undergone several forms of body attachment and conditioning. The ego develops and strengthens its hold through ignorance. When suffering comes upon us, suffering helps to loosen these bonds of attachment and releases the jiva, this individual soul, from the I and mind syndrome. In fact, this is the reason why Jesus talked about the cross. Bhagwan said, cut the eye, clean across straight, cut the eye, let it die on the cross. You crucify this eye and then you become free. Swami Vivekananda once said, the world is a gigantic gymnasium wherein we come to develop our spiritual biceps and muscles. We tend to move into the world's bylanes, fascinated by the world of sense enjoyments and worldly attachments, and in the whole process we miss the goal of life. Challenges help one to develop their spiritual biceps. In fact, in the Old Testament, there is the story of Job. Job, from the Old Testament, is a story which gives very important lessons in the light of what Bhagwan has mentioned as often. He lived in the land of Uz. He flourished during the biblical times. He was blameless, he was upright, he was honest, one who feared God, turned away from evil. He was a very sattvic person. And he was very prosperous. A gentleman with clean character. At the same time, he had all the worldly comforts and wealth. He had 7 children, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, and many servants. And in the book of Job, the Lord praises Job for his good and noble qualities. But Satan wants to challenge Job's integrity and test him. And so, Satan undertakes this task with full vigor, and as a result, Job begins to suffer. Job suffers terribly. One day he loses all his possessions, his camels, his sheep, his oxen, everything goes. And then a whirlwind hurricane happens and all his 7 children die because the house collapses. Overnight, he has lost all his children, he has lost his wealth, he has become a devastated man. It is unimaginable catastrophe for a person who had everything. And Job looks at the Lord and says, O Lord, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That is all Job says. Job did not complain. Job did not question. Job did not cry. Job did not shake in his faith. His surrender became even more solid. He never said, why me? When I'm so good, why this happened to me? And that is not all. The story does not end there. The willy Satan has more in store for Job. Job is next smitten by a rare and painful disease. He is covered all over his entire body with pus, painful boils and sores. He sits all day among a heap of ashes. For relief, even his wife gives him up and says, curse your God and die. And then, to top it all, 3 of his friends visit him in this hour of trial. They criticize and blame him and say, it's because of your evil deeds that you are in this present pitiable condition. And Job searches his own soul and finds that he has been innocent of any crime, any sin. But these friends blame him. He finds his friends' talks very shallow. He finds them so compassionless, merciless. He finds their arguments so empty. He rejects their explanations, but Job does not say a word. The friends are unable to place themselves in his shoes. They neither empathize nor pray for his well-being. Job was undergoing what is called in Christian parlance the dark night of the soul. He's left all to himself to grapple with his problems in silence. And in this silence and deep contemplation, he seeks the source of solace and refuge. The process of inquiry, deep inquiry begins. Self-analysis, introspection becomes intense. And as this self-analysis gathers momentum, Job slowly gravitates rapidly towards the inner core of his being. The Lord alone is his shepherd. And Job develops complete dispassion for the body. He develops complete detachment to the world and what the world stands for. And in the deep silence, he hears the voice of God. The voice of God, which says, "The two ferocious animals responsible for your bondage have been destroyed." And Job understands that. And Job is totally transformed. What are the two animals that the Lord mentions to Job? The Lord calls them Bemoth. Bemoth is the enemy within, the ego, the self-centeredness. Swami refers to these six enemies, Shadaripus within us. Ego being the head of this pack of vices. And the second is Leviathan, the enemy outside, comprising the world, the flesh. This is the I and mine. Conquering these inner and outer enemies, the inner and outer purification happens and Job merges into permanent peace. Swami says every spiritual aspirant has to undergo this purification process, lose the body attachment, break away from the bondage of I and mine. Job attains that state of equanimity. Job always knew that God knows what he is doing. One of these days all the answers will come in. In the meantime, we have to rest in confidence that he knows what he is doing. It is this power of faith and devotion that will lead to discrimination and dispassion and make one immune to worldly sufferings. So when Bhagwan here in this segment says that this world is mithya, it is neither satya nor asatya. The world is neither truth nor untruth. It is mithya. It is relatively real. And because we are born in it, we are unable to distinguish it, unable to grasp that reality, which is the fundamental basis of this world. In Prema Vaini, Bhagavan says the characteristic of a spiritual aspirant is the attainment of truth. In this false world, there can be no true living Satyachara is not possible in this false world. There can be only false living, only Mithyachara, Swami says. True living happens only in the realization of the Lord. In fact, in that discourse that Bhagavan gave in Venkatagiri, Bhagavan says, divine life does not admit of the slightest dross in character or delusion in intellect. Every person is Satchit Ananda Swarupa. Every person is, in fact, truth, awareness, bliss. Just that we have to wake up to that awareness. From the atom to the universe, every single entity is moving towards that estuary where it is, where it merges in the sea of bliss, Bhagavan says. In fact, once the divine life becomes the very breath of our beings, the divine life which consists of truth, love and non-violence, Swami says, how can anyone be false to another when there is no other at all? Once you are in that life and living where you are operating from the inner self, then you will only see unity. And when you see only unity, how can you be false to another? Because there is no other. Falsehood comes out of fear. Where there is no second, there is no fear. No one is loved more than the self. So when all is the same self, everyone around is the same self, then why will you love someone more and someone less? Why will you hurt someone and why will you want to injure someone? Automatically you will be practicing non-violence. Bhagavan says, to do that churning within us, just like the milk has to be churned for butter to emerge, even as we live in this world, to know that this is mithya and to all the time focus on the satya, the fundamental basis, is what will lead us to the experience of unity. And the journey towards this is quiet acceptance, like Job did. Quiet acceptance is the best armor against anxiety. Bhagavan says, in that discourse, Bhagavan very beautifully gives a clue and says, you must all try to become egoless. You know what will happen when you become egoless? The Lord will accept you as His flute. Swami says, when a number of people ask me what they would like to be in the hands of God, Bhagavan asks people, what would you want to be in the hands of God? And some people said lotus, some people said conch, and some people said gada and so on. But Bhagavan says in that discourse, I advise you to become the flute in the Lord's hand, because then the Lord will pick you up. He will put you onto His lips and He will breathe through you. And out of the hollowness of your heart, the hollowness created because of absence of egoism, the Lord will create captivating music for all creation to enjoy. Therefore, be without any will of your own. Merge your will in the will of the God. Inhale only the breath of God. That is the divine life. That is what I want you all to achieve, Bhagavan says. That beautiful discourse. So dear listeners, in this segment, Bhagavan clearly says that the world, even though it seems real, it is unreal. The only thing that is real is the satya, the purusha. In fact, Bhagavan goes further in explaining and expounding this purusha in the subsequent parts of this segment, and we'll come to that in the next episode. What we have to focus from whatever Bhagwan has mentioned in this part of 9.2, Bhagwan is asking us to all the time know that we are born in mithya, we are born in illusion, and our job is to move from mithya to satya, to that which is the basis. And for that, the cleansing of inner and outer self, the purification of inner and outer tendencies is a must. Everything we in life that we go through is towards this process, and this will ultimately take us to the state where the happiness is not fleeting, where the joy is lasting and the bliss is permanent. So dear listeners, we'll continue this in the coming episodes. There are many more things that Bhagwan has given us in this segment 9.2, and we'll pray to him to continue this session in the coming episodes of Vahini Satsang. As always, if you have any queries, you can write to listener@radiosai.org. You can also send us your comments on our WhatsApp number 9393-258-258. Offering this little endeavor at his lotus feet with gratitude and love, I take your leave. Thank you so much. Sairam.